American businesses need more skilled workers. How do we find the talent? How do we go about developing it? And how do we create opportunities for everyone in our society to get a good job? You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation, a nonprofit media company telling stories about the future of work, the future of education, and closing the job skills gap. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace. We talk with innovators, educators, decision makers, people with ideas and solutions for today's workforce challenges. As we ring in the new year and peer into the next decade, let's take stock of where we are when it comes to the jobs of the future and how we're going to prepare for them.
We essentially train people to go from zero to being a software developer, or zero to being a data scientist, zero to being a product manager. Now, are you going to be a 20-year ninja expert by the time you're done with our program? Definitely not. But you are going to be ready to take that first role that will then get you on a career that is going to be high growth and in demand for many years to come.
Jake Schwartz is co-founder and CEO of General Assembly, a training and career transformation company specializing in the high-tech skills businesses need today. You could say it's a moving target. The speed at which technology is changing right now is making our heads spin. But Schwartz says that's been true for centuries.
I think the first thing we have to look back is over the past several hundred years, we've had technology change that has changed the nature of work many times. If we're really talking about IT technology, right, information technology, and how most of the things that we call businesses sort of conduct themselves, you know, I think we have to go back to the 50s into IBM mainframes to really start to understand the start of that journey. Now, I think, there's a couple of important things to think about with that. Number one is that at every point along that thing, that chain, it has created jobs more than destroyed jobs. Although in the micro, in almost every case, it destroyed jobs initially or seemed like it might. You know, when mainframes were brought in, it really replaced rooms full of people that were called computers, right? And their job was to make all sorts of calculations all day long. And so this is, you know, I think this is part of a long-term secular trend that, you know, goes across, you know, a couple different centuries. And so we should think about it in that way. Now, what's happened in the last, say, 30 years is that the accessibility of these incredibly powerful microprocessors and, you know, a device in every pocket and all of that has created, you know, a much larger consumer base consuming and using, purchasing and developing on these different platforms. And that has sort of accelerated the rate of change, right, around what work looks like. But it's also connected to other things. You know, we've been in a period where, you know, we've had incredibly low interest rates for the last, you know, really 10 years. And it seems like in a lot of ways, this conversation really accelerated over those last 10 years. I think it's partly to do with technology. You know, we've seen the sort of ascendancy of these major technology monopolies and just the dominance of them. But there's another connection to it, which is that when interest rates are so low, when capital is cheap as it has been, you know, the investment decision of, you know, capital, do I capitalize and go invest in a machine to do things in more efficiency, or do I invest in software, or do I do that, versus people, which is a classic economic trade-off that people have talked about since the beginning of time, I think it's tilted pretty unfairly in the direction of capital over labor. And so I think that's all a preface to say that I think in some ways what has changed is employers' expectations of what employees are able to bring to the game on day one. And that's really what's changed.
A classic theme over the past century has been that robots are taking over our jobs. Every 10 or 20 years, we see alarmist headlines predicting the demise of the worker, thanks to whatever new technology is emerging at the time. As someone who has his finger directly on the pulse of the information age workplace, I was curious what Jake thinks about this.
I don't think we as a collective sort of unit of humans are very good at figuring out what the narrative is in real time, because we're projecting it towards the future. And so we look at data points, we try to understand what's happening, and we construct a story. So yeah, the New York Times, I think it's like almost once a decade would print a story about how robots were taking over. One of my favorite sort of 20th century robots are taking over story was the first ever ATM. Automatic teller machine.
Exactly.
Terrified people. It was in the financial district in London, right? Barclays Bank. And the prognostication was that it was going to destroy the bank teller job. There was going to be so much fewer bank tellers. It was a very big part of employment, I guess. What's interesting is now you look back and it's all cute and funny, but really what happened was that ATM machine actually enabled a whole different economic explosion of growth in bank branches, which actually dramatically increased the number of bank tellers.
Exactly.
Right? And so I think you have to start any conversation saying, we don't really know the future. We barely know what's going on in the present. So what can we observe and what's happening? I think from our seat at General Assembly, what we see is that, and because we work with, you know, about half of the Fortune 500, we work with individuals, mostly in these sort of very millennial-friendly urban environments. We are certainly growing beyond that pretty quickly. Is that what we see is that there's a couple things. There is a tremendous demand on the employer side for certain types of skills that weren't even really thought of as a core driver of success in business like, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, you think 10, 15 years is a long time, but in the scheme of, you know, Bureau of Labor Statistics and, you know, university programs, that's an instant. And so the rate of change accelerated, so people couldn't keep up, right? When we started GA, I remember, you know, asking one of our friends who was working at a desk here, you know, who was complaining he couldn't hire any UX designers. I said, well, where do you go? Where do you learn UX design? He said, well, there's not really a place to learn it. You just kind of have to do it. I think a lot about, you know, like Paul Allen or Steve Wozniak, these people sort of in the early days of sort of the personal computer explosion. You know, the story was they were tinkerers in their garage. And I think even through the 80s and 90s, most of the people that I knew that got really into computers and ended up having like really interesting careers afterwards were people who, for whatever reason, got fascinated in their, were in their mom's basement coding away when most people were going to football games or whatever. But that's not a great way to create sort of an army of skilled workers, right? That's a sort of ad hoc guild of sorcerers is sort of how I think of it. And so our goal was really to break down that guild of sorcerers and say, no, we can make this a fairly accessible and easy thing to do. And we know that there's a tremendous demand because the growth curves of the activities that these companies want to do are much larger than they expected or foresaw 10 years earlier.
So now you're working directly with businesses to create that pathway to get those non-tinkerers who don't work in the garage and get them ready to be a workforce. You're arming them with the skills that they need to be in the workforce?
Yeah, well, we really, you know, we started in New York City. We started amongst the startup scene. So the skills that we really focused on were the ones that were very immediately apparent were in high demand. Software development, UX design, product management, digital marketing. These were things where the description of the role had shifted. Even the role itself may have been sort of invented or had come to mainstream understanding only recently. Data science really has come up since we began and has become really big. When I went to business school, I took a class in data mining. That was what it was called. It's kind of funny. And so, you know, we sort of started in that area. We happened to get somewhat lucky, and then that was an area that was going to explode. And
don't say luck, you just knew it.
Well, it was immediately apparent. It was obvious, is what I would say, from where we were sitting. And I think that's luck, to be in a place where something is obvious. It's typically, you know, it was just right in front of our face. But because of that, you know, what we found is that we're really in the middle of a two-sided marketplace between individuals and companies, right? Or employers and employees. And the minute you sort of see what we do in that lens, it's really interesting because I would guess that most quote-unquote educational institutions would never frame themselves in that way. But secondly, it means that we have sort of a dual obligation to both our students, which we feel very, very strongly about, and we sort of protect that mission at all costs, but also to employers, to A, help them understand where their industry is going and what they need to do, and make sure that we're helping them create those talent pipelines that enable them to do the work that they're hoping they can do to remain competitive, right?
So are most of your students young or on the younger side, or do you get middle career workers?
When we started, we were very much targeting the millennials, right? Just because it was just a frame of reference, right? So I think our, you know, in the first few years, our median age was around 26, our average age was around 29. So not hyper young, right? I mean, still kind of in that balanced 20s and 30s period. I would say as we've gotten bigger, we've certainly had many case studies in students who, you know, get into their late 30s or early 40s or even sometimes 50s and 60s. And I've talked to some of these people, and it's always so inspiring. I think at some level, that's because there's this idea that technology is only for the young, and after you get to a certain age, you're just hopeless at it. And that's just a weird, insane thing. I mean, I would get it if we were like talking about like lifting boulders and moving it from one thing to the other, but this is about using a computer, right? And for most cases.
Yeah, we can use computer, we can use our phone.
Right, like it's not dumb. Right, yeah. Right. So it's such an odd thing. But I think it's that a lot of that comes from, you know, we've all been trained to think about work and careers through this very specific and limited lens of there's this thing that you, I mean, I guess the hyper limited example is you go to school, you have a major, you graduate with that major, you get a job in that major, you work your way up in that career for 25, 30 years, and then you're sort of at the top of your game where you are earning the most, but probably working the least, benefiting from all that expertise that you've had, and then you retire, right? And that's been sort of this model that people sort of have operated in from, is this is what it means to have a career, what it means to make work meaningful. It's what we all have to do to be useful members of society. And I think that is in some ways blowing apart. And I think we should, you know, I think part of it comes from the fact that corporations are not interested in that mutual investment over 30 years in the same way. I think at the same time, though, individuals aren't interested in that kind of lifelong model either.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they've kind of changed. Our mindsets have changed.
And if you believe that, you know, economic mobility helps the market system work better and helps everybody sort of earn what they're worth, that's a good thing that people can move around, right? I was just over in Japan where the level of sort of employee churn is dramatically lower than here. And it has kept salaries lower, which you could argue is good, but it also keeps innovation lower. The level of skilled workers is a real problem for them. It is still incredibly gendered, where you know, the majority of women are not expected to work. And even out of college, they take sort of relatively supporting clerical jobs in order, you know, until they have kids. I mean, these are all generalizations, obviously, but you know, so all of these factors kind of work together. And so, but we have to sort of start and say, okay, our understanding of work has changed. I used to believe very strongly that economic necessity is what drives those cultural understandings to shift. I'm not sure about that anymore. I think it works in a very complicated dance. And so we have to be somewhat philosophical about it. But what we do know is that, you know, we are in a place right now where we're almost at full employment. We have more jobs available than workers to fill them.
Workers with the right skills.
Workers with the right skills, although also literally workers, right? And those skills are shifting so fast that it's hard to even know how to get those skills in order to do it. And what we also know is that it's this tragedy of the commons situation where everybody talks about somebody should do something about this, right? I was at Davos this year. Somebody should do something about it. Everybody likes to talk about it. And I will say, as somebody walking around saying, hey, we're doing something about this. Who wants to, you know, work with us on that? When it comes time to put the money up, to think about this as an investment that is required to maintain productivity, we find that people are really stuck in this model of thinking about talent and HR in a time when the dynamics were very different than they are today.
And we see that very much at Working Nation, because I will report on something, and I'll write an article, and it'll be something that's happening in Los Angeles, where I live. And then I realize it was in the LA Times, I wrote about it, and everybody I talk to does not know it exists. And so that's like, awareness is one thing, and then reluctance is another. So, because I wanted to kind of get to this point that workers don't know what to do. And I think there needs to be somehow, the businesses have to reach out to their own workers and get them reskilled. Media has to start talking about it in a way that's meaningful and show that there's solutions out there. And educators, you're an educator, and traditional education is not there yet. So I think you're filling a role that traditional education has been reluctant to do. And I was curious how you felt about that.
Well, I think, so I've developed a lot of opinions over the years. I think when we talk about somebody needs to do something, right, and they're not aware of it, I think there's a much simpler explanation, which is that developing skills is not a cheap thing. There are not cheap shortcut opportunities for this. Every once in a while, you'll see somebody announce, oh, we've installed this online platform at our company, and therefore our skills problem is solved. And everybody who knows kind of shakes their head, because it's like, that's not the way it works. The reality is this takes real investment. And the way to get anything, anybody, whether it's a company or an individual or a government, to make a big investment is for them to believe that the returns are available. And there's a sort of outsized economic opportunity on the other side. Now, I think two things are happening around that. One is most employers don't actually have very good detailed quantitative models on what their return on an individual is inside their company. The ones that do typically are the sort of high-end service firms that, you know, can authentically say our people are our best asset, because it's true. You know, McKinsey, if all their first and second year analysts walked out of the door, they wouldn't have a business anymore.
Right.
And so we see them really thinking critically about this, but they've always had to think critically about this because that was their business. Most businesses thought of as just inputs and outputs, and like, okay, maybe you have to pay a little bit more if you can't find them, or you can poach or whatever. Not like, oh my God, there's a fundamental shortage and we have to come up with an alternative way to get these people. Otherwise, we are not going to be able to do what we want to do. Now, what's interesting is if you're a manufacturer and one of your vendors goes out of business or all of a sudden can't keep up with the pace that you need, what's the first thing you do? You have a big meeting and you say, okay, we have a crisis in that we're not going to meet our production goals because one of our vendors is inadequate. We need to either go find another vendor. We need to rethink our entire supply chain and how we work with it. Or maybe we need to vertically integrate upwards into that in order to be able to meet our own demand, because it might mean that there's an economic opportunity. When it comes to people, it's very, very rare that companies think about it, even though it's another input to this value add.
That's a great point. That is something I hadn't really ever thought about. You're right. If you're not getting what you want from an outside company, you're going to just say, we're done with them.
Right. Yeah. So I think there's a huge element to this of like, okay, well, one of the things is I don't think a lot of companies, they know in generally they have a problem, but they can't put their finger on it. They're not used to thinking in that way. There's always other things to blame. And then there's always this other sneaking suspicion I have, which maybe it's just not as big of a problem as the media makes it out to be, and we all think with the statistics. I'm pretty sure that's not true, but I think it's something we should always consider, because, you know, if you believe that, like, you know, companies are rational actors and they're going to do what's in their own economic interest, I think at some level you would say, well, you know, something isn't, they're not feeling the pain the way they should. They may be misattributing the pain. They may have bigger concerns because they're all being disrupted, but it's worth considering.
This is Work in Progress, and I'm Ramona Schindelheim. When we come back, more on the value of higher education, and my guest Jake Schwartz offers one word for today's graduates.
Data, data, data. It doesn't matter if it's marketing, if it's operations, if it's finance, if it's sales, data is the secret.
The The future of work is changing. Are you ready? If you're not yet familiar with Working Nation, let me tell you a little about us. We're a nonprofit media company made up of seasoned journalists, producers, business leaders, and educators. Our mission is to bring awareness to the impact changing technology is having on the workforce. A lot of people are talking about the problem. At Working Nation, we're focused on solutions. We're looking at the programs that are out there, and we're talking to the people who are working to close the skills gap, the gap between the skills employers need in a workforce and the skills workers actually have. We do this through Working Nation videos, articles, live events, and of course, podcasts. All of these and more can be found on our website, workingnation.com, your source for all information on the future of work. Let's get back to my conversation with Jake Schwartz, CEO of General Assembly. Before the break, we were discussing the need for businesses to upscale their own labor force in order to stay competitive. But what's the role of traditional universities in all this?
This is sort of the other piece of this system, because what has happened, and this has started to become talked about a lot more, is that the price of higher education has increased faster than healthcare, about twice the rate of inflation, really since the 1980s, if even earlier. And I can tell you, it's not rocket science why, right? It's because we had a giant third-party payer system, just like healthcare, where government said, hey, any amount of money you want to spend on your education, doesn't matter what you study, doesn't matter what the results are or how good the institution is, we'll subsidize it as best as we can. And then we had sort of a doctrine or religion in society, which is anything you spend on your education is an investment well spent, right? And what happened, I think, is post-financial crisis, interestingly, this sort of idea started to come out of, is the debt worth it? Is the risk reward actually paying off?
Is it getting you the career that you need?
Especially in light of, in those years, like when GA was founded, over a third of college graduates said that they were in a job that did not require a college degree to do at all, right? So we had a whole generation of overeducated, underemployed people. And I think that is a much longer sort of cycle to undo, because it's so deeply buried in our unconscious of just the value. It's become almost a form of religion. I sometimes like to compare degrees to indulgences, right? And that our existing higher ed infrastructure is not unlike the pre-Reformation Catholic Church, right? Who has a monopoly on granting these pieces of paper that somehow denote economic salvation. And it's going to require that level of reformation in order to change it. But the reality is when that much money of society is all being pushed into this really inefficient and questionably effective system, although it is the best system we have today, and most people still believe in it, there's not a ton of extra resources. So this is why there's always this thing of companies say, oh, the government needs to fix this problem. And I'm like, well, government doesn't know what you need. You need to fix this problem. And if you can fix it, it should be a competitive advantage for you, right? And for individuals who are willing to sort of take that leap, there's a great way to play off of that vacuum of people taking action, because they can get themselves a skill that gives them a real competitive advantage in the labor marketplace, because not enough people have those skills. But if you think of it as a market, it's very clear that just the real question is, why isn't anyone at scale making these investments? And I think one of the answers is that people haven't quite felt the pain. I think another thing is that we have an entire incumbent system that is sucking up a ton of investment every year and doesn't really want to change or let go of that.
So you just announced recently that you've got a partnership with Microsoft on AI jobs training. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I'm so excited about this partnership with Microsoft, because, when we were starting GA and this idea of like, we're going to create these 3-month programs and it's going to help people become software developers or UX designers. And it's the stamp of GA is going to say, you should at least look at hiring this person. One of my core inspirations for this was in many ways the Microsoft certification programs of the 90s that I felt like really were interesting and served a role, but that were just in some ways a little out of date and not applicable to sort of a big chunk of the world that was really in need of these kinds of alternative paths to expensive degrees. And so I, for years, have been trying to do something with Microsoft, right? Because just to sort of get them sort of in this new era, and you can see under Satya how much more they've embraced open source, which is a big part of this trend. And so I sort of felt like that was the right moment to approach them again and talk about this. And we happened to find some like-minded people out in Seattle and started talking to them about what we do and how we might be able to work together. And the simple reality is this, you know, Microsoft sells to every major and minor corporation in the world. And they are right now in a incredibly intense competitive race with a couple of the other large players to really be the cloud that, you know, enterprises use to do all of their computing in the future. This is really like the invention of a new operating system and a new type of machine, more or less. And so, you know, their entire organization has really mobilized around this idea of how do we help our clients move to the cloud faster, more efficiently, and use this stuff because this is the future. And so what they need and what they're finding is one of the core blockers to making these their clients making these changes is purely that they don't have enough skilled people in their operation to actually accelerate their sort of shift to the cloud. And the irony of this is a lot of that is because they have these huge IT functions that are all people using, you know, managing the on-prem systems that Microsoft also sold them, right? And so we are really partnering on the entire large idea of cloud computing, making those shifts. AI is really the most, you know, powerful use case of this. And building not only coursework and pathways, but also true assessment competency-led certifications around these ideas so that companies can actually, at scale, build a real pipeline for the future.
So when you talk about the coursework that you're creating, for us laymen, what kind of classes are we talking about? What kind of knowledge are you providing?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you know, we essentially train people to go from zero to being a software developer, or zero to being a data scientist, zero to being a product manager. Now, are you going to be a 20-year ninja expert by the time you're done with our program? Definitely not. But you are going to be ready to take that first role that will then get you on a career that is going to be high growth and in demand for many years to come and be very interesting. The majority of our students not only make more money after going through our programs, they also report being much happier in their jobs, which I think is really important. So we essentially are building entire generation of entry-level tech workers in the jobs that are really in demand and helping them get those first jobs, which we also take responsibility for as well. So they're all approximately 3 months in length. We have sort of the career change version of these programs are 3 months full-time. They're very, very intense. It costs around $15,000 to participate in one of these programs. But then, you know, our sort of data all says that you will get payback on that in less than a year, which is, you know, especially in this low-yield environment, the best investment you can make. And so, you know, that's basically the model. We also have part-time programs for people who want to ladder up or explore other possibilities. Maybe position themselves for a different type of role or an expanded role inside their existing job. And so those are basically the two things we do. And we do it both for big companies at scale. We do it for individuals at all our campuses and online around the world. And I think that's been essentially the model since 2011, and it's just gotten bigger every year.
And then you talk about setting an industry standard.
Yes.
I'd like to hear more about that, because that's a very important thing, I think, as we move forward, that businesses and individuals both understand what it takes to fill a role, particularly an individual.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we found was that both sides of that market, right, the individual and the employer, are struggling because one of the consequences of these jobs and skills and platforms and stacks changing so quickly is that unless you are a up-to-date expert, it is very hard to know what good looks like. So think about that from a hiring manager's perspective. You get a job description from your stakeholder in IT. You start to go out there looking for this person. You have a very hard time telling who says they're good but is actually good versus who says they're good but is not. And add to that another level, which is that, you know, as we know, the way job descriptions get developed and then executed on, the best way to defend against that is to create years of experience and proxies like where you worked previously and things like that, which then just injects a ton of bias and artificial barriers into your process, which make it harder to find the people you actually need. On the flip side, imagine for individuals. I am reading all the time that being a data scientist is a great career choice. There's jobs galore, I can make a lot of money. That sounds great to me. Now what? Where do I go? I can definitely do some stuff on LinkedIn Learning or whatnot, but at the end of that course, what do I know if I'm good or not? How can I tell? And this really becomes the opportunity. And so what we've really tried to do is you work with those employers to create assessments around very clear rubrics of what the jobs actually require, not what they say they require. And there is a difference there. And then sort of use that to build a transparent channel on both directions. And we're really still in the early stages of building this. And I think one of the key things is that to do that right takes time and depth and investment. And what we see is a lot of people sort of pretending to do that sort of on the surface and being a mile wide and an inch deep. And we are trying to go as deep as possible. So we have, you know, standards boards made up of like the executives of some of the leading companies in that industry, helping us develop the career paths and the assessments and understanding the dynamics of each one of these things at a pretty micro level. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to build is a currency. And that currency has to be bought and sold by everybody in the ecosystem in a credible way. And I think this is the thing that all of the micro badges and online certifications have really missed, is that if nobody is going to make a hiring decision based on it, it's not worth anything. It's not worth the paper it's printed on. It's not worth the bits that you know that it has it up in the cloud.
Trends in jobs. You know, you talked about data analysts. Do you see any trends? Because we like to tell people where the jobs in the future are going to be. Do you see anything new out there right now?
You know, what I like to say is I think this whole learn to code thing, which we definitely surfed in the early days of our company's existence, is a little bit overblown. And it's a great thing to learn how to do. It's a great way to learn how to think. I think everybody should at least have enough comfort with it to understand what a computer program is and how it works. But if I was really to think about what you need to know that you're going to have just a great high growth career and be able to add value wherever you land, I think the real story is data. Data. Numeracy at the core level, right? Being really good with Excel is a form of knowing data. And you'd be surprised how few people even know how to do that, right? Outside of like, you know, the investment banks. And so I think every, you know, young kid that I talk to who wants to know what they should do with their career, I say data. It doesn't matter if it's marketing, if it's operations, if it's finance, if it's sales, data is the secret. That is the real mega trend, especially around companies, because it is the language of all of this. And it's much broader than just the IT department. And so that's what I would say, you know, data analyst, data scientist. It's really all on a spectrum around being able to use different tools and different scales of data to generate insights that are actually actionable for your organization.
And it's not just for the more obvious tech companies. It's used in every business out there.
Every single business. I'm talking industrials, consumer goods, retail.
Sports.
I mean, sports almost. Yeah. I mean, they've been. They were one of the first ones.
Right. Even for things like fan experience.
Correct.
And marketing.
It is everywhere. It touches everything, every part of the economy. So that's probably the best bet that there is.
Work in Progress is produced by Working Nation, your source on the future of work. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, and we've been talking about plugging into the job trends of the next decade with Jake Schwartz, CEO of General Assembly. To find out more about the GA career training and workforce transformation programs, visit their website, generalassem.ly. To To learn more about the future of work and workers, visit workingnation.com and subscribe to Work in Progress wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Annie Chelsea, and executive producers Joan Lynch and Melissa Panzer. Our theme music was composed by Lee Rossevere and licensed under Creative Commons Attribution License 4.0 International. See you next time.